Hi, guys. Welcome back. This is MatchChat episode 212, featuring the second installment of my interview with Mr. Dave Gilbert of Wajidai Games. In this part of the interview, we talk about the Blackwell series, Gemini Rue, lots of other games, and then a lot about Steam and the opportunities and also the dangers of that platform. A lot of great stuff here, so without further ado, here is Mr. Dave Gilbert.
Well, in 2003, you started the Blackwell Legacy, which I guess was Bestowers of Eternity.
Oh God, yeah.
First, and, you know, trying to put the story together here.
So. Wow, yeah, you've done your research. Yeah, Bestowers of Eternity was a freeware game that was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. I tried to wipe it from the internet, but it's impossible. It's still out there. It started with Bestowers in 2003, I think. It was 10 years ago. Jesus Christ, yeah.
And the game stars Rosa, a writer who apparently is a bit of a medium.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to tell you more, yeah. I guess.
I'm trying to set you up, you know.
There's getting up to a question or not. It's the series is about a woman named Rosa Blackwell who is kind of this, a bit of a social misfit, kind of awkward. She's trying to make it as a writer, and then her aunt dies, and she discovers that she's from a family of mediums, and she's got the spirit guide in the form of this kind of 1930s Rat Pack-ish ghost named Joey. And their deal is that they meet lost spirits and try to help them find their way. And they usually do this by investigating their lives, trying to find out about them, and helping them move on that way. And over the course of investigating that kind of thing, they uncover some big supernatural thing, which they have to stop. That's the premise of most of the games.
Also, I noticed there's four of them so far, with the fifth mm-hmm. in development.
Yep.
So how much has the game changed over these various versions?
Well, let's see. I think I've gotten better at making games. I think Blackwell Legacy was the first game, Blackwell Legacy. I replay it now, and all I see is the flaws. People seem to like it. And people even still say they like it. But all I can see is all the mistakes I made where the characters just talk way too much. Not really a lot of gameplay. It's mostly story. And the main character, I knew she was supposed to be awkward, but I made her a little too awkward. And these are all criticisms that I've given to myself all over the place. I'm my own biggest critic of the game. But I think over time, I've sort of given more thought to not just what makes a better story, what makes a better game, but how to mesh the two together. I've always tried to think more about, okay, how does this work as a game? Like, how does this work as an interactive thing? And I think that's where adventure games are the strongest. It's not just telling a good story. It's about how to make it immersive and how to make it give the player more agency in what's going on, how to make them feel that either it's happening to them or it's happening because of them, not just it's happening passively. So that I always give a lot of thought to that. So I think the games have steadily improved with that in mind over the course of the series. And the first game, I didn't think of any of that stuff. So I look at it now and I wish I could go back and change everything, but it's too late. Yeah,
those factors seem to be a problem with lots of adventure games. It's trying to figure out how much exposition do you need. Mm-hmm. It's easy to go overboard, especially with the dialogue. So I'm kind of wondering, where do you draw the line? And like, okay, that's too much dialogue or that's too much exposition.
I think if it's something that the player can uncover themselves, then don't just spout out so much dialogue. I think a big mistake in a lot of these games is the introduction, where they spend a lot of time introducing the world in non-interactive cutscenes. And I think I draw the line at like five pieces of information. Like, you need to tell the player just enough to get them interested in the world and what's going on, and then let them loose, let them explore and kind of figure it out themselves. Because if you're creating a world, part of the joy comes from exploring that world. So you don't need to tell the player everything about the world, just let them explore it. It was interesting because they were used to these making these casual games like Mystery Case Files and things like that. And I never even gave this much thought before. But the interesting thing about adventure game puzzles is that you not only have to figure out how to solve the puzzle, often you have to actually go looking for the puzzle itself. You don't know something is an obstacle. You don't quite know that this is an obstacle, that this is a puzzle to be solved. You don't know it unless you play around and try to, you know, experiment and see what happens. And that's sometimes the problem with adventure games is that you're never quite sure what your current goal is. You think, okay, you're trying to find someone, and okay, there's a guard over there who's blocking some building, but you don't know what's in there. But as a seasoned adventure game player, you know, well, something's got to be in there. So you try to get past him, but that's not really a specific goal. It's kind of this nebulous thing of, all right, here's this broad thing I have to do, and here's a guy, here's an obstacle, and so there's got to be something past it. So it's an interesting, and I think that was an issue, like going back to what I was saying about Gabriel Knight, is that a lot of the first half of the game is just a bunch of obstacles to get past with no real reason to. And I think that is a problem that I have a lot of the times with the games I make, is that, okay, I have this area, okay, there's, you know, some obstacle or obfuscation or whatever it's called, like something hidden deliberately, and you have to solve a puzzle to get past it. But sometimes you just never quite the players lean a lot more direction these days. You need to let them know that there's something here, kind of guide them towards that place. And it's a bit more challenging now to do that without making it, hey, look over here, without making it really obvious. I don't know if I'm making any sense at all, if I'm even answering your question. There's no real right or wrong answer. It's just what works. Usually I just design a bunch of things, play it, get it tested, see what the reactions are, and then fine-tune it from there is what I normally do.
Yeah, I was thinking, as somebody who's developed so many of these and also published so many of these, there must have been several instances where you realized, just by the volume of emails alone about a certain puzzle, you know, there's something that went wrong here.
What's funny is that I've noticed a lot of times when I design puzzles, I try to keep them very grounded in reality. And there was this one puzzle, I think, in Blackwell Deception, where you're looking for someone's cell phone. And, you know, he was last seen in this one particular area, and you're looking for his cell phone. And a lot of people got stuck there, and they'd email me for a hint, and I would just say, well, when you're looking for a cell phone, what do you normally do? They're like, oh, yeah, right, you call the cell phone. And a lot of people had trouble making that connection, even though it's the most natural thing to do in real life. It's just not something you think of doing within the context of a game. And I found that fascinating. Like, they just didn't think to do that. Or in, I think, Gemini Rue, there's this chase sequence where these bad guys are after you and you're running from them and you end up in this room. And you close the door and then they break in. If you wait too long, they break the door down. They enter the room and they shoot you. And they're like, how do I stop these guys? I'm like, well, did you try locking the door? Like, oh, yeah. Never thought to do that. Like, it's just these very the most obvious thing. Like, they'll combine the paperclip with the candle and do all sorts of obscure things, but they won't think to do the very obvious thing, which I found very interesting in the course of making a lot of these.
So you don't have any situations like in Gabriel Knight 3 with the cat and the mustache?
They will never, never hear the end of that. I feel so bad. No, I did have a weird dog leash puzzle that a lot of people don't like, but in Blackwell Legacy, you have to get a dog to follow you and then wrap its leash around a pole, and it's stupid, but yeah.
So Blackwell Deception is 2011, right? And is that the game you consider to be the best of the Blackwell series?
Well, at the time I did. I think every game is, now that I've been working on Epiphany and I'm loving it so much, I look at Epiphany, I look at Deception now, and of course I see all the flaws, but I think it was the first time I really merged the gameplay and the story together really, really well. I'm very proud of the ending. I'm really proud of the story and the characters. I'm really proud about how everything came together. I wish I didn't skip so much on the graphics. I kind of let the graphics slide to focus more on the gameplay, and I think the game is really strong for it, but everyone complains about the graphics, and I kind of agree at this point. I could have done a better job there, but I think the game is definitely the best.
Okay, so 2009, we get Emerald City Confidential, which is, of course, based on the Wizard of Oz canon. So a couple of questions about that. Why the Oz canon?
Well, let's see. I loved those books when I was a kid, and I read all the original 14 by L. Frank Baum, and then moved on to the other authors before I stopped. And I was always very impressed with the Discworld noir game, where it took Discworld, this very fantasy-ish world, and put this wonderful noir spin on everything. And I always thought to myself, well, if I ever got the chance, I would love to do that with Oz, knowing it was public domain. And when PlayFirst approached me about doing a game for them, it's the first thing I thought of. And I pitched it to them, and they liked the idea, so we went for it.
That's got to be huge. I bet people don't realize that that's in the public domain.
Yeah. The funny thing, the interesting thing is all of the books are in public domain, but the movies aren't. So it's anything that was specific to the movies you cannot use. Like, you can't use the ruby slippers because that was not the book. You can't actually use Oz in the title, which is bizarre. That's why you get like Tin Man and Wicked and Emerald City Confidential. Little things that you just can't use unless they were in the books as well. It's interesting. There's a lot of legal stuff there. But yeah, it was fun to work on.
So I think I read somewhere where it took you $200,000 to make it.
That was the budget. That's the budget they gave me. A lot of that went to making the engine and the art and a lot of that. Like, we had to make an engine from scratch because we were using the Playground, PlayFirst toolkit called Playground. So we had to make an engine based in that, which was very, very difficult and took a lot of time. So that that was like a quarter of the budget right there, was just to make that engine. And just, you know, the time and things like that, paying everybody. It was, when you reach that level of a production value, things become a lot more expensive, obviously.
Maybe we should, you know, back up a little bit. So how did you get into this deal with PlayFirst?
Oh, okay. Well, how did I get into the deal with PlayFirst? It goes back to the GDC 2007, when I was nominated for the Choice Award. I got into, I got snuck into this party hosted by PlayFirst called the Diner Bash, based on their Diner Dash game, because I think that was the year that they released it, or at least the year that it kind of got really successful or something. But the creative director sat me down, and I was really drunk at the time. I didn't take it seriously. And he's like, we really want to do a casual point-and-click game, and we think you'd be perfect. I'm like, okay, great. And I knew nothing about PlayFirst. I knew nothing about casual games. And I looked at their catalog, and I'm like, I don't make games like this. I kind of blew it off completely. And then later on, they got back in touch with me. They're like, no, we really want you to do this. So I said, oh, okay. So I almost blew it. So that's how that started. That's how that came about. It was an interesting experience because I came from, you know, a very old school adventure game background, and they were casual game developers, and they wanted to make an adventure game for the casual audience. And so I didn't really know much about casual games. They didn't know much about old school adventure games. So we both, I think over the course of it, we were kind of second guessing each other. I sort of, they would give me advice, and I would always do whatever they said. It took all their advice. Making it a little bit more casual than it probably should have been. I don't know if you've played the game, but it's very hand-holdy and very, very easy, even by my standards. And I think that harmed it more than helped it. But I still love the game. I love the story. I love the art. I love everything about it. I would never be able to make a game with that kind of high production value on my own. So it was really nice to work on.
Okay, so let's get to the game and you know, everybody, I guess, knows about by now, and that's, and of course, Gemini Rue.
Mm-hmm.
The cyberpunk game is not written by you, though, right? We have Joshua Nurnberger, I believe.
Yeah, Josh Nurnberger. He.
So how'd you meet him and learn about the game?
Well, it's kind of goes back even farther than that. I knew that thing about adventure games is that they're very asset heavy, and they take a while to make, and they're very niche. So, I realized very quickly after a year or two that each game would have to do really well in order for me to fund the next one and continue living. And I'm in this for the long haul. I'm in this to earn my living. I'm not just doing this as a hobby or as a side thing. Like, this is my living. And especially at the time I was engaged, I knew that I couldn't just, you know, live off of one game at a time and pray it did well. So I decided to get into publishing, and I started with Aaron Robinson's Puzzle Bots. And so that was the first game we published. And then I think because of that, people knew I published games. Josh approached me with Gemini Rue, and he said, yeah, you know, I just want to get this done and just not worry about anything afterward. Can you take it on? And so I looked at it. My wife and I both played it, and we both loved it. And we're like, yeah, well, we can work on this. So
what did you like about it?
I love the look of it. I love the feel of it. I love the – it felt very hardcore. Just the subject matter was just very, you know, trench coats, spaceships, rain. And not only that, like the story kind of worked really well with the environment. And it was really mysterious. Like, the whole Delta 6 scenario was really interesting. And we were on the edge of our seat. We were up all night playing it. We loved it. And we just, based on our initial impression, we knew this is something that could take off. And so we said, yes, we would love to take this. We helped with the voice acting. We got that done. And we helped with the QA. I have a whole team of QA people that help us with our games. I got them playing it. We paid for some art assets to be made. All the character portraits were made in-house. Well, in-house meaning that we paid for a freelancer to do it, if that makes any sense. And we launched it, and we've been kind of curating it ever since. We got it on Steam. We got it ported to iOS. We're working on getting it ported to Mac and Linux right now. So we've just sort of taken it on as ours. And that's really exactly what Josh wanted. He basically gave us this wonderful, wonderful thing, and we've been taking care of it, I guess is the best way to put it.
Was that the first of your games on Steam?
No, Puzzle Bots actually came first. Okay. Puzzle Bots came first.
Was that a relatively easy process to get them on Steam? Or did
No. I don't know if it seems with every game we launch, there is a little bit of a dance to go through. They reject us. We prove ourselves in some way. And then they take us again. Puzzle Bots, Blackwell, they rejected. Puzzle Bots, they rejected.
Did they give you a reason why they rejected?
No, they never do. That's the email never gives you any reason why they reject it. They just, it's their policy. I can understand why, because they probably would have to deal with countless defensive developers, you know, getting all defensive and things. So I understand why, but it's still very, very frustrating. So like Puzzle Bots submitted, got rejected, but then it got into the PAX Prime showcase. They accepted it. Gemini Rue got rejected. And even despite it being like the number 5 PC game on Metacritic and being an IGF nominee and everything, I ended up having to hire a guy who could go into their office and pitch it to them for me. And they took it. And then Blackwell got onto Indie Royale when Simon Carless was involved.
Simon.
Yeah, and so because of like every game on Indie Royale had Steam keys and Blackwell wasn't on Steam, managed to kind of shove it onto Steam that way. Resonance, I pitched it to them. They were kind of iffy about it, so we got like tons of preview coverage. Everything was glowing. We made a pitch, and then they took it. Primordia, they rejected it, said go to Greenlight. We went to Greenlight. It got shot up to like number 40 in 2 weeks, which is unheard of. And so then they took it because it rose so fast. And now like with Blackwell Epiphany, they tell me, yeah, we'll let you know, we'll review it and let you know. So I still haven't got that in yet, which is getting a little frustrating, but whatever.
Is it a windfall when they get on Steam, or does it?
Yeah. Right now it's a very awesome place to be in and a very scary place to be in, because Steam is really it. I mean, in terms of, pure market share, the hearts and minds of gamers, they buy games on Steam. It's almost like Steam is just where they get their games. And it's not really a platform or anything. It's just where people get their games. They think, I want this game, I'll go to Steam and get it. And if it's not there, they just won't get it, because it's just a very convenient place to store all your games and keep all your games, all your data, all your friend lists and achievements and things like that. They want everything on Steam. It's almost like if it's they don't play it through their Steam client, it doesn't count, which is weird. And so by not having the game on
Steam. Especially for an adventure game, that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it didn't make sense. I didn't quite understand it either, but once it got on Steam, it's not like it's a magic bullet. You still have to do all the marketing and PR pushing that you would normally do. It's just that more people will be willing to buy it because it's on Steam, which makes it a big windfall for when you can get on there. But it's also a very scary place to be, because if they decide they don't want to be indie friendly or they stop taking my games or something like that, then we're in a very difficult position. We have to figure out, we have to really step up our PR game. Because right now it's very easy just to kind of put everything on Steam. I don't even really try to push things off my own website anymore because it's like 2% compared to all of Steam. So it's a very difficult place to be in because if something happens, what do I do? And I think a lot of developers are in that position as well. So Steam is great. Like, we're doing really well. We got in there just at the right time where indie games are starting to get really big. And we had a really long, nice long tail of games to see us through. So we're doing very well. But, you know, I'm always thinking 2 or 3 years ahead.
And that's all for this week's episode. Hope you guys enjoyed that. I should be back next week with the third and final installment of my interview with Mr. Dave Gilbert. A lot of great stuff coming up. Also, look at the website, mattchat.us, when you get the chance. Really been building this up with some great blog posts. I'll be putting some audio podcasts up there soon. And also, you can donate and support the show. Really means a lot to me, guys. You can subscribe to the show for $1 a week or $5 a month. Doesn't sound like much, and you probably won't miss it, but it does make a huge difference on this end. So, thank you very, very, very much to all those who have supported the show. Now, what about that ale of the week? This week I've got something very, very special indeed. This is the July 2013 Surfside Ale from the, let's see, who does this one? Lucid Brewing Company. So I've had some of theirs on before. I think I had a Lucid photo several episodes back, a really good one. They're out of Minnetonka, Minnesota. And the story behind this beer, it's brewed for the Spirit of the Lakes Festival. So it's only brewed just for that festival. So there's very few people that have access to this. It's actually at the local grocery store here in the they have a guy, I guess it specializes in buying beers like this. So he comes running up to me because he knows I do the reviews on the show. And I wanted me to try this because it is so difficult to find. Apparently those two cases that he bought is it. So this might be the first and last time I get to sample this. Anyway, let's get it open. I guess I should give you a little bit more information about it. Let's see, German-style lager, 5.5% alcohol, so not too bad there. Sailing at sunset. I guess that's the photo there on the bottle. Anyway, it looks good, but let's get it open and see what it tastes like. All right, so I've got some of this Surfside here in the rather excellent drinking horn. Been smelling it. It's smells kind of like a wheat ale. There's some sort of a cherry thing is going there. You can smell a little bit of the hops, but not an overpowering aroma. I hope there's more flavor there than smell. Anyway, let's give it a go. Okay, a little bit of a kind of a creamy, nutty sort of taste with this. Doesn't taste anything like a wheat ale. I was thinking based on the smell. Not a lot of flavor here, actually. I'm going to give it another taste. It's kind of a little watery, for lack of a better word. Kind of that sort of that soggy cornflakes kind of flavor that you get with something like a Bud Dry or Bud Ice. Not really enjoying this too much. I don't know, maybe it was better when it was at the festival, but this is just kind of a mediocre beer at best. Let me give it one more taste.
just a very very watery, not much flavor there at all. I think I'm going to have a word with that guy at the grocery store about his taste selections. Anyway, on a scale of 1 to 5, I'm going to go maybe 2 out of 5 drinking horns on this. You know, I would prefer this to, I guess, a maker brew. But definitely, there's so many more, much better ales out there, especially from Lucid. Go for their Lucid Photo instead of this one. It's 100 times better. Anyway, let's wrap this up with a quotation. And the quotation, I was looking for quotations about art and mystery, and I came across one by a scientist named Francis Bacon. You probably heard of him. And it goes something like this. The job of the artist is always to deepen the mystery. See you guys next week.
This book, sir, contains every word in our beloved language.
Every single one, sir?
Every single word, sir.
Oh, well, in that case, sir, I hope you will not object if I also offer the doctor my most enthusiastic contrafibularities.